A Pitlane Punters production.
To another episode of the Pit Lane Punters podcast. My name is Joshua Brock, of course, and joining me, as always, is Anthony Lucen and Zach Deldale. We have a very American-focused podcast this week. We are talking NASCAR, we are talking IndyCar, and of course, the Saudi Arabian Grand Prix was on the weekend. We'll be chatting about that too. But I did mention them before. G'day, Anthony and Zach, though, boys. How are we doing?
Oh, not too bad, Josh. It's come to an end of another motorsport week.
It has. And Zach, mate, how you been doing?
Yeah, good, mate. Motorsport world starting to kick into gear. And I mean, things are a bit quiet on the Australian front, but there's plenty to talk about around the world.
For sure. And I guess that's what we're looking at some of the news stories and stuff like that this week. It is quite an American heavy focus pod this week, isn't it?
It is. But first, we've got a new segment that we're going to trial, aren't we, Josh?
Yes, it's very, very exciting. I know some people have commented, and we really appreciate the feedback you've been giving us too. Remember, you can do that, of course, on Spotify or on our socials on Instagram as well, at pitlane_punters, for some more short-form sort of stuff. And we thought it'd be cool to kind of do, whilst we talk about news, we realise that sometimes people don't have an hour or so out of their day to talk about in-depth issues and don't know what we're talking about. So we've decided to do, alongside, in parallel, and will be part of our show from now on, is some news headlines, some motorsport news headlines. And Anthony has been very kind to put together the first ones, the first ever Pit Lane Punters news headlines. So let's have a listen now. Over to you, Anthony, with this week's Pit Lane Punters motorsport news headlines.
Making news this week in the world of motorsport and kicking it off with Lewis Bates, who will be the latest Australian Rally Championship star to compete in the FIA World Rally Championship, with the 2022 ARC champion to run in this year's Rally de Portugal in May. The 27-year-old Canberran will make his debut in the WRC2 class in his brand new Rally 2 spec Toyota GR Yaris before bringing it to Australian shores in time for round 3 of the Australian Rally Championship in Queensland. Bates says he's very excited about the opportunity to compete in Rally Portugal and can't thank the Safety Culture CEO and fellow ARC competitor Luke Anir, along with all his other sponsors and supporters, enough for making it happen. Back home, an Erebus Motorsport Managing Director, Shannon Keeley, will leave the team following next weekend's Australian Formula One Grand Prix. Having joined the Melbourne-based team in mid-2016, she worked her way up from Media and PR Manager to her current role of Managing Director, which she has been in since 2021. Erebus Motorsport has indicated that the departure is not due to the ongoing Brody Kostecki saga, with the popular figure tipped to have a break from the sport altogether. 2010 Supercars champion James Courtney believes the Australian Grand Prix Corporation has to do more to better accommodate Australia's premier racing category. Supercars will be parked out in tents in the infield of the Albert Park circuit, having lost the secondary pit lane to Formula 2 and Formula 3 for next weekend's event. The Blanchard Racing team driver believes that rain would also majorly take away from the event, and says that if the fake floors that they're on out in the tents end up with mud coming through from underneath, it'll be a bitter pill to swallow whilst trying to work on the cars. Further to that point around the weather, we understand that a red flag could be put out if rain does start mid-race to allow teams to safely change tyres, with mid-race pit stops not an option if that was the case. Two young, fast Kiwi supercar stars off to Malaysia this weekend to race in the Sepang 12-hour endurance event. Walkinshaw Andretti United's Ryan Wood will race in a Porsche 911 GT3R for Alabama Motorsport, while Grove Racing's Matt Payne will race alongside team owners Brenton Grove and Stephen Grove in their brand new Mercedes AMG GT3. Nathan Hearn will return to Australian shores and race in Trans Am Australia this weekend at Race Tasmania, following spending the past year racing in the American Trans Am Series. He'll return to competition as a privateer, having run with Gary Rogers Motorsport in 2022, and will use the car that he won the 2021 championship in, a Dodge Challenger. James Moffat swept the opening weekend at Sandown back in February, with Hearn looking to join the championship fight against him, along with Supercars drivers James Golding, Tim Slade and Todd Hazelwood. And finally this week, Supercars has announced that the Sandown 500 will be brought forward by a week, following talks between the Melbourne Racing Club and the country's leading motorsport category. The new date will now see the event take place on the weekend of September 13 to 15, where the illustrious 60-year history of the event will be celebrated. That could cause trouble for one team, however, with Grove Racing looking to re-sign Frenchman Kevin Estre. However, the new date now clashes with the World Endurance Championship's Fuji 6-hour event in Japan, where Estre would be in action as part of Porsche Penske Motorsport's WEC Hypercar program. That's the latest in motorsport news for this week. Check back in the same time and same place next Friday for more motorsport news.
And Anthony Lewsome with the first ever Pit Lane Punters weekly motorsport headlines. Thanks for that, Anthony. That was good stuff, mate.
No worries. I didn't have much else on to do today, so I figured I'd let you boys take a break and I'd throw on my newsreader voice that I won't be using for much longer into action. Or I guess I can keep using it on the podcast, but yeah, some new opportunities for me in the not too distant future.
Yeah, really exciting stuff. And I'll tell you what else, it is kind of cool. We're going to be releasing those weekly in parallel to the normal podcast too. So if you've only got 5 or so minutes and you want to hear some of the main stuff that's going on, make sure you, of course, follow, like the podcast and give us a review whenever you get the chance. It really helps us in the algorithm. But boys, let's talk NASCAR, because there's been a bit of news, I guess, brewing over the last couple of weeks, and we haven't really had time to talk on it, but it's probably a really good chance to do that. But I guess actually before we do that, you guys were at a launch event yesterday for the 2024 ARC season opener at the Rally of Canberra. I know it was the season finale last year and we were part of it, but there's a brand new sponsor on board, isn't there, Zach?
Yeah, there is. TechWorks Automotive, a local Subaru specialist mechanic based out of the ACT, out at Fishwick. They've jumped on board this year, which is tremendous. And they're actually an entrant as well, with Mick Harding being the driver of the Subaru WRX and also sponsoring the event that he was saying at the event today he's been attending, competing in, and just loving since the 1990s. So he's absolutely rapt to be on board. We had Harry Bates out there as well, one of the ACT's finest, last year's Rally of Canberra winner and the reigning Bosch Motorsport Australia Rally Championship winner as well. So a great event, and I've got to give props to our news reader Anthony Lewsome. He's also an MC extraordinaire. He loves the sound of his own voice, does our friend Anthony.
I tell you what, I definitely do not. And having to wear headphones to do this does not enjoy that experience whatsoever.
Yeah, well, Anthony, you mentioned on the just before in our first ever news, I guess, headlines about Lewis Bates, Harry Bates's younger brother, going over doing the WRC2 stuff. And I know he wasn't there today, but Anthony, you were emceeing the show today. I guess from your point of view, what was sort of the launch event like for this year's Rally of Canberra?
Well, we got to see a new car that's going to be competed in by Mick Harding and his co-driver James Thorburn, but not quite yet for the ACT rally that's only just arrived in Finland. But it was cool to see their Skoda Fabia cross Subaru Impreza. Skoda Fabia R5 body with their Subaru running gear underneath it. It was cool to chat to them and get a bit of a feel for what that car's like, and when look at a potential timeline for it to come into competition. But yeah, no, running the event and getting to talk to those guys and have a chat to Harry about how his off-season and prep's going. He received his new Rally 2 car that we reported on a couple of weeks ago that cleared customs last night. But it is now here in Canberra. He picked it up yesterday afternoon. So it is here in Canberra, and it is now coming or will be used for the Rally of Canberra in a few weeks' time.
That's really cool. And I guess one thing I really like about the Australian Rally Championship is how, I guess the rule, and I don't really fully understand how, but the rules allow for cars to have different running gear. I know we saw the Fiesta, I think it was the R5 body shell in the Fiesta last year with Mitsubishi Evo running gear. Like, that was just bizarre. So I guess it is cool. A Skoda Fabia with Impreza running gear, I guess it's not too different, but it's just interesting that the rules allow for it.
It's not something you really see in a whole heap of motorsport categories around the world. Very sort of regulated, and that sort of the car that you run has to have the running gear from that car as well. So it's kind of cool to see these sort of Frankenstein creations getting pushed to the limit out on some of the toughest stages this country has to offer at the Rally of Canberra early next month.
Yeah, well, I guess we're talking about cars that aren't very stock. Let's go talk about some stock cars right now. Let's head over and talk about NASCAR, because there's been quite a lot of different news stories coming out of the land of the free the last couple of weeks. A lot of little interesting stories and tidbits that we haven't really had the chance, but one of the big ones is, especially if you're an Australian motorsport fan and you've been watching motorsport for a long time, Zach Lee Diffie might be getting a new job.
It certainly sounds like it. So he'll be on assignment with NBC at the Paris Olympics covering track and field for them, which he did at the previous Olympics in Tokyo, and he called the 100 meter final for them, which is the biggest American sporting event television wise in an Olympic year. So extraordinary for a guy who, believe it or not, he started off as a PE teacher in Brisbane before he started in motorsport commentary, and of course he called supercars for a long time, and now he covers IndyCar for NBC mainly, but sounds like he's off to the NASCAR Cup Series to be their lead caller later on this season after the Paris Olympics. So NBC's regular caller Rick Allen will continue as the lead caller during the Paris Olympics. I do believe, I could be wrong on that, but sounds like Lee Diffie's going to take over at the end, which is absolutely extraordinary. He has done a few cup races before, but it sounds like it's going to be a full-time gig. And can I just say, I'm absolutely frothing at the thought of Lee Diffie calling home a Shane Van Gisbergen win on a road course. That's something pretty cool for Australian motorsport fans, I reckon.
Well, it wouldn't be the first time that we've seen Lee Diffie having a chat to Shane Van Gisbergen. Obviously, when Shane went over to race in Chicago last year, that NBC put together a package that Lee Diffie actually went and to the Trackhouse Racing Workshop and sat down and did the interview with Shane, because they would have just missed each other crossing paths when by the time Shane started in Australia, in Australian motorsport, before or after Lee Diffie had gone across to the US. So, I'm definitely looking forward to hearing Lee's dulcet tones on Fox Sports here in Australia for the NASCAR stuff, because I'm not paying or not going behind the double paywall that is Stan Sport to watch IndyCar. So I'll leave that to you, Zach.
I'm curious to know what his form of boogity, 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 boys, let's go racing is going to be.
Well, I do know what it is, actually, which probably shows how much of an absolute nerd I am and how much I study Lee Diffie's work, for a lack of a better term. But it's always it's time to bring the action for Lee Diffie, which is a pretty, obviously, with a lot more bravado than I could muster up. But it's going to be pretty cool to have Lee Diffie on commentary, and Rick Allen will still be around for NBC when they take over for the back half of the NASCAR Cup season, after Fox Sports' allotment of races in the first half of the season runs out. But Rick Allen will still be on Xfinity coverage. So Rick Allen will still be calling the majority of SVG's races in the Xfinity series, or the second tier of NASCAR and Xfinity, in the back half of this season.
And I guess Lee Diffie isn't the only new thing potentially. Well, he's not potentially. He's definitely coming to NASCAR after the Paris Games, as you mentioned. But there is some other potential big new things coming to NASCAR. I know this rumor has been swirling around for a number of years about another big manufacturer coming in. I know NASCAR for a long time, or for a little while, had four major manufacturers, Dodge being the last major manufacturer to be a part of NASCAR, and Toyota being probably the newest, well, it still is the newest manufacturer to be a part of NASCAR. But Honda, the rumors around Honda are starting to gain some traction, you'd have to say, Zach.
Yeah, for sure. And of course, the rumors of Honda being involved in NASCAR are certainly helped by Andretti's involvement in NASCAR now. I'm having bought a stake in Spire Motorsport, who run Corey LaJoie in the Cup Series, which is the entry that most people would know Spire Motorsport run. They also run the 71 car for Zane Smith, who is another trackhouse contractor driver, just like Shane Van Gisbergen, farmed out to another team. So these rumours have been going on for a while, but it's certainly not unprecedented for a manufacturer of non-performance cars. Like we see Chevrolet run their Camaro, Ford run the Mustang in Cup Series. Toyota, on the other hand, they run a Camry, and it sounds like Honda are probably going to run something along the lines of a Honda Accord, I would imagine, in Cup Series. So certainly not unprecedented for a more, I guess, mundane car manufacturer, for lack of a better term, joining in the Cup Series. And it certainly sounds, well, where there's smoke, there's fire, right? So I certainly think it could... it definitely could happen. Sounds like 2026 is going to be the year where Honda will join, if they do join. But I guess the question now arises around what Honda's involvement in IndyCar looks like. Of course, being one of two engine manufacturers alongside Chevrolet.
Well, Honda have been involved in NASCAR for a while. They've been a safety car, have they not?
I'm not so sure on that one. I know Toyota have been. With the proper stock version of the Camry, but Anthony, you got something to say?
I was just going to bring up that Honda also expressed their interest in NASCAR back in 2019. So the interest has certainly been there for a while. But down that road, they then decided that they were going to pursue IMSA more than, or IMSA and IndyCar more than stock car racing, and that turned out to work out well for them because they used their Acura Motorsports hypercar to win the 2022 Daytona 24 Hour. So it's not the first time that we've heard these rumours going around, but now that they've done that and conquered that, it could be time for them to come across and join the global stock car racing.
Well, I know the Accord is obviously the most likely model, but there has been rumours of the Integra potentially coming back. I don't know. It's not really a sedan. The only real... the Civic's not... Civic's kind of a sedan.
Well, you say that, but the Mustang isn't a sedan and the Camaro isn't a sedan and Toyota run a Supra in Xfinity Series. So there's certainly precedent for it being a two-door car stretched out over what's effectively a four-door chassis, like we saw on Australian shores with the Frankenstein Gen 2 Mustang.
Yeah, so it'll definitely be interesting to watch this space. I mean, I was watching a video the other day about what sort of teams would probably be looking like being a factory Honda team or would switch to that manufacturer. I know there was sort of like the introduction of the Toyota, or Toyota coming to NASCAR, is pretty much what made Joe Gibbs Racing. Joe Gibbs Racing back in the early 2000s and mid-2000s was a second or third tier Chevrolet team. and then becoming the powerhouse, Toyota powerhouse we know today. So there's some potential for some sort of second or third tier manufacturer teams to potentially to jump up to some spotlight with some manufacturer support they probably wouldn't previously have the privilege for. Especially Chevrolet, Ford, and Toyota, they've all got their top teams. So yeah, it'd be interesting to see. And I think it's only going to be good for NASCAR.
Oh, 100%. I wholeheartedly agree. And we're seeing now, even with the established manufacturers, the lower teams, they're now starting to create technical alliances with the big teams. So on the Ford side of things, Front Row Motorsport now have a technical alliance with Team Penske. So they're basically a satellite Penske operation, and we see that with so many other teams as well. But I think definitely having another manufacturer in the Cup Series, I think it could be a great thing. And we know Honda's got a fantastic pedigree in American motorsport, particularly in open wheel and sports car racing. So it'll be interesting to see how Honda go if they join NASCAR.
For sure, and we've been talking about some good things that potentially coming to NASCAR and are coming to NASCAR, but some things that have been quite contentious over the recent weeks. I mean, this was a popular addition to the calendar, the North Wilkesboro Raceway, coming back to the calendar and getting resurfaced and reinvigorated as a venue, a classic venue, I guess you could say, for NASCAR historically. But there's been some conjecture about the quality of the resurfacing and the, I guess, the renovations that have been going on there.
Yeah, there have been. And, of course, North Wilkesboro came back to host the All-Star Race, which non points and very much almost like a kind of speedway-style heat racing kind of scenario. But back in the day, North Wilkesboro used to host 400-lap marathon races, which sort of worked brilliantly for the venue because the race had time to play out and sort of develop. And now with modern cars being a lot quicker than the cars that used to run at North Wilkesboro from the mid-90s back, hasn't quite worked out. And there's been some sort of a lot of conjecture about whether the All-Star Race should be held at North Wilkesboro. And now that there's conjecture about the resurfacing and the I guess, the modernization of North Wilkesboro, because let's not forget, it had been left abandoned for basically since they last ran their, last NASCAR Cup race in the mid-1990s, 1996, I think it was. It had basically been left abandoned and left to rot. I think the only time I saw any cars driving on track in the intervening period was when the Top Gear boys went around there in some high-end luxury sports cars, if you think way back to, I think it was about 2010 or some time around then. So
that US special.
Yeah, yeah. So I think for sure, there's obviously a bit of conjecture. I think North Wilkesboro does have a place on the calendar. I just don't know if it's the All-Star Race, the shorter sort of more action, go-go-go kind of racing. If you ask me, Atlanta's the perfect place to host the All-Star Race because we saw the racing that they had a few weeks ago, which culminated in that absolutely incredible three-wide finish where the top three were covered by, 0.04 of a second or something absolutely ludicrous. So I think there's certainly places where NASCAR can have the All-Star Race that would be a lot more suited to it than North Wilkesboro, but I do hope that Wilkesboro does stay on the calendar, particularly for all the hard work that Dale Earnhardt Jr. Put into reviving North Wilkesboro.
Well, the track's owned by NASCAR now, is it not?
I dare say it would be. Not 100% sure, but it would be under International Speedway Corp ownership or management, I would imagine, just like the majority of NASCAR circuits.
Yeah, for sure. And actually, I was thinking about, because like classic, I started becoming a NASCAR fan back when the EA Sports had the games back in the mid-2000s, and Charlotte Motor Speedway was always been the All-Star Race going through those games. And so when I think of the All-Star Race, I think of Charlotte Motor Speedway. But I kind of, thinking about it, Zach, especially the race we saw at Atlanta, but not only that, Atlanta is the closest we have to a super speedway where the cars are unrestricted. So I think in terms of challenge, speed, and just the challenge of handling these unrestricted, beasts of stock cars around, pretty much, they'd go just as fast around Atlanta as they would around Daytona or Talladega in terms of top speed. So I think, I'm kind of with you. It makes sense to go to somewhere as challenging and incorporates NASCAR as much as what Atlanta does when you think NASCAR. But I guess other bad things that NASCAR don't like, Joey Logano's glove.
Well, Joey Logano, or as he might also be known, Peter Parker.
For those who are not around the story, Joey Logano got in trouble by NASCAR for having a webbed glove, basically. A race glove, but it had heaps of webbing between all the fingers. It was his right hand, being the car being right hand drive. So it was his non-dominant driving hand, so he could still change gears and everything. But it was to close a hole in the window to improve aerodynamics, which I guess if you're a Formula One fan of old or of the early 2010s, you might remember the F-duct where the Formula One drivers were sticking their hand beside in the cockpit. I don't know if, Anthony, if you remember the F-duct era.
No, I don't.
No, it's, again, one of those crazy aerodynamic engineering things in Formula One where it goes for a season and then gets outlawed, you'd have to say, Zach. And I think it's going to happen here in NASCAR too.
I think it already has been outlawed. NASCAR Tech confiscated the glove, and I think Joey Logano or Team Penske, can't remember which, but I think they might have copped a fine for it, somewhere in the region of five figures. But it's, when you think about it, are we really that surprised? Because Joey Logano's team owner is a man by the name of Roger Penske. Now, Roger Penske is notorious for trying to find that unfair advantage that just scrapes inside the rules. So are we really surprised that a Team Penske driver has been found to push the edge of the rules like that?
It reminds me of a certain 2019 Bathurst 1000, and that's all I'm going to say.
I think it's a bit different to that, to be perfectly honest.
I'm just going to say Penske Gate.
But it's the culture of NASCAR is to try and push the rules as much as possible, whether it's illegal parts that flex, or I don't know if you remember the original Car of Tomorrow. I think it was Sam Hornish Jr. in the 77 had this ridiculous setup that basically made the car crab walk, but on intermediate speedways, cookie cutter speedways, it was incredibly fast and no one could kind of catch it.
Well, you talk about the All-Star race. That's where that made its debut back in the late 2000s. And Sam Hornish Jr. was driving for Team Penske. So there you go.
Yes.
But I mean,
I forgot that car was a Team Penske car.
But I mean, like, NASCAR's got this history of outrageous sort of team, outrageous, I guess you can call it cheating, but maybe it's not cheating at the same time. Like, All-Star Race 1997, Jeff Gordon and the T-Rex car for Hendrick Motorsport that absolutely wiped the floor, and that and NASCAR just said, well, you know what, just don't run that car again. It's a bit too good. Or even, you know, way back further into the 1960s, and a man by the name of Smokey Unick, who you boys might not know, his car passed all the technical and template inspections, but he built a car that was a 7/8 scale replica of a stock car. So all the dimensions were still right, but it was smaller and it was more agile. Like, these are the kinds of things that NASCAR has sort of been built on.
Which, considering that the sport was built off the back of bootleggers running moonshine, yeah, makes sense.
It does, 100%. And NASCAR is the most regulated it's ever been now. Like, if you're just a hair's width outside of any sort of technical regulation with these next-gen cars, because that's the whole point of NASCAR next-gen, every single car is identical. So if you're just a minuscule out, like, you get in a world of trouble nowadays.
Sure, and I guess someone who wasn't in trouble on the weekend, Anthony, you'd be all around this. Shane Van Gisbergen had a pretty good run in the Xfinity Series on the weekend.
He had another fantastic run in Xfinity Series on the weekend. Wasn't quite the best qualifying for him, but he still somehow ended up P6. The man just knows how to pull off miracles.
Well, I mean, I think he was helped by the fact that he did skirt his way around the big one towards the latter stages of the race. But then again, if you keep your nose out of trouble in Xfinity, then odds are you're going to have a pretty good run. And he was 10th at the final restart with at overtime with two laps to go. And he sided his way past four cars in two laps. Like, the guy just keeps on getting better and better with every lap he spends on an oval. I'll get my words out eventually. But, and I mean, he's only going to get better with the more experience he gets. And a lot of these circuits he's going to return to later on in the season, because NASCAR do a lot of return trips to these sorts of two ovals. So, I mean, if he keeps on improving at that rate on his first visit to an oval, can you just imagine the sort of things he's going to do on second trips to an oval? Now, I'm not saying he's going to win an oval race at all this year. If he does, that's just absolutely outrageous. And to be fair, if anyone could, it's Shane Van Gisbergen, the best racing driver on the planet at the moment. But his next race, he gets to turn right and left. So, tell you what, he's in pretty good nick to be heading to Circuit of the Americas, which, let's not forget, this is a track he has previous experience at. He drove there in 2013 when V8 Supercars went to the Circuit of the Americas. Now, it's not the same configuration. Supercars ran on the short configuration. NASCAR run on the full Grand Prix spec. But I'll tell you what, he's got a little bit of experience won't hurt Shane. He'll at least be familiar with the track. But the thing he's been saying he's really been struggling with is the track limits. So NASCAR have a liberal interpretation of track limits, shall we say. You're not allowed to cut any corners, and through the S's, you got to stay within the white lines. But if there's any tarmac on the outside of any corner that isn't in the S's, you can use all of it you want. So realistically, people just make up their own damn track at COTA. So be interesting to see how Shane goes with that. But, I mean, you'd back him every day of the week, right?
Yeah, terrible reference for all those born in the 90s and 2000s. As a Lindsay Lohan would say, the limit does not exist.
Wow. I thought you were better than that, Josh. I thought you were better.
That's terrible. I'm sorry. Our older audience will appreciate it. Our older audience will appreciate it.
I don't even get it.
Yeah, that's fair. But on the note, he's got some interesting competition at the Circuit of the Americas in both the Xfinity race, and obviously he'll be in the Cup series as well, doesn't he, Zach?
He does. So in the Xfinity series, he's got to look out for some torpedoes, because Daniel Kvyat, ex-Red Bull Formula One driver, podium, Anthony, don't look at me like that. It is his nickname. And he's scored podiums in Formula One. He's back in Xfinity Series this weekend. And Kamui Kobayashi returns to the Cup Series. He ran at the Indianapolis Road Course alongside Shane Van Gisbergen last year for 23-11, the team that is owned by NASCAR Cup Series star Denny Hamlin and some bloke who used to shoot hoops called Michael Jordan. Heard he goes all right. So some interesting competition there for Shane Van Gisbergen. But to be fair, he beat both of them last year. So I've got no concerns that he'll do it once again at the Circuit of the Americas. Not this weekend coming, but the weekend after.
Yeah, it's worth mentioning too, that race that Kimi Kobayashi was at last year too. Brody Kostecki was there as well. But it does mean in the Xfinity Series that Shane Van Gisbergen, Zach, you mentioned to me before we went on air, he's currently 14th in the standings. That is despite the DNF that he had with the blown engine in Vegas.
I mean, he's having an outstanding rookie season, isn't he? And very similar, if you look back through the stats, and I did hear this on another podcast, eerily similar to Marcus Ambrose's first four races in Xfinity Series as well, or in the Nationwide Series, if you look back on it. So keep in mind, Marcus did have experience in the Truck Series before he moved up to Xfinity, but kind of cool to see just how similar the two legends of Australian motorsport are. And we're talking about Tasmania a little bit more later on in the show.
For sure. And the next NASCAR Cup Series event is at this weekend for the dirt race at Bristol, which should be really exciting. And Shane Van Gisbergen takes the track in 2 weeks' time at COTA, as Zach mentioned. Hey, let's talk about IndyCar now, sticking with American motorsports, because we did say it was a very American-heavy pod this week, because there's just been so much news. There has been quite an interesting development, I guess, in the way, well, not development, but I guess controversy, argument, debate about how the future, what the future of the sport looks like, specifically when it comes to teams' charters. Now, I know, Zach, you're quite around a lot of these motorsport structures and series structures and stuff like that. For those who don't understand what that even means, what does a team charter mean? And, like, I guess, can you compare it to supercars even? So some people might be able to relate that back.
Yeah, so the team's charter is very similar to the TRCs that we have in supercars, the team's racing charters. So basically, it's all the teams get their share of the pie, or their share of the money that comes out of supercars through broadcast deals and all those sorts of things. So IndyCar don't quite have one. So what they have is, it's called a leader's circle. So every team that finishes in the top 22 in points, I believe they get $1 million. To sort of go into funding them for the next season. So they don't quite have a charter system, but it's something very similar. Now, the thing with the charter system, and it'll be very similar to the one they have in NASCAR, if you own a charter, you're locked into a race. You're to race, no matter how you qualify. So with NASCAR, it's something like 32 charters off the top of my head, and the rest are all, you got to qualify to get in. But the thing with NASCAR is that they only get enough cars to sort of fill a field anyway. So the only race you really see anyone not qualify for is the Daytona 500 at the start of the year. It'll be quite similar in IndyCar, but the thing is that the only race you don't see people qualify for in IndyCar is the Indianapolis 500. Now there's a lot of tradition that goes into this here, so I'm going to try and make it as brief as I possibly can. But the tradition with the Indy 500 is it's always been the fastest 33 qualifiers make the race. It doesn't matter how big of a name you are, if you're not in the top 33, you don't qualify for the race. And probably one of the most famous examples of this is Team Penske in 1994. They absolutely dominated the entire race with their Penske Mercedes Benz chassis. The Mercedes-Benz engine was built to USAC regulations, as the race was sanctioned at the time, instead of CART or IndyCar sanctioning. So it was a pushrod engine that was mighty powerful and just absolutely blew away the competition. They came back in 1995 with their traditionally engined car, I guess you could say, for lack of a better term, the 2.65 litre turbocharged V8, and none of them qualified for the race. So Penske went from dominating the race in 1994 to completely missing the show in 1995. So that's sort of the most infamous example in Indy 500 history. Now,
any more recent, you got the Fernando Alonso thing as well.
Exactly right. And last year even, Graham Rahal missed the show. Like, an absolute veteran of IndyCar racing, completely missing the show. Although in saying that, he did come into the show later on when Stefan Wilson got injured in a practice crash and Graham had to fill in for him. So, yeah, there's a lot of history that goes into this, but basically 33 fastest cars have always qualified for the Indy 500, apart from rare exceptions, which we might touch on a little bit later on. But basically, with Penske trying to bring in the charter system, it locks in the vast chunk of the field and leaves a few cars to fight their way in. And now, this has happened before at the Indy 500, and it was controversial back then. It's still controversial now.
I guess the disadvantages of having a charter system is that there's a little bit tighter control over the grids. Like in Formula, well, we think Formula One's kind of, it's got a franchise model, which is, you know, the same sort of concept. But back in the day, anyone could rock up with the car and qualify as long as it was within the regs, as long as they were within the 107% rule and there was enough grid capacity. And now you've got the case where there's only 22 cars. Again, NASCAR's a great example. Growing up, I remember anyone could qualify. I think the top 32 cars were always good on teams' points. But, I mean, is this just the way motorsport's going? It's becoming more professional. It's too expensive for Joe Bloggs in the garage. Does it even matter anymore? Like, I don't know, Anthony, keen to hear your thoughts on something like this.
Yeah, it feels kind of bizarre. Like, I get there's a lot of other motorsport categories in the world that use the TRC, but I mean, the fact that Roger Penske owns IndyCar as a racing category and then owns the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, he's definitely not short on money. I know he's trying to grow the profile of the category and put more money into it that way, but I think there's better ways to go about it than asking teams to all of a sudden cough up $1 million per car to run this way.
For sure, and I think that's probably why it's so controversial. I guess another controversial thing too is, I guess, the state of the cars. Zach, the chassis 10 years old. I know they've been talking about running hybrids, but that almost seems dead in the water.
Not dead in the water, more sort of on indefinite hiatus. It's been tested in the off-season, and they just haven't been able to build them up in time. The initial plan was for them to make their debut last weekend at St. Petersburg. They very much did not do that. So I think the current plan now is to have them debut at Mid-Ohio, which is like event 10 of 17 off the top of my head this season. So a very similar situation to what we had with Gen 3 here in Australia with supercars. Like, it was initially meant to be, what, the start of 2022 was going to be Gen 3. Then it was pushed back to, it was going to be a mid-season introduction for a completely new car. Then it got pushed back to 2023. So I think we might be looking at a very similar situation here. The DW12 chassis, which has been run since 2012, and it was named after the late Dan Weldon, who has just had a documentary released about him literally last night, I think, as we record this. It's been a great car. It provides awesome competition, don't get me wrong, but yeah, it's just getting a bit long in the tooth now. And I mean, you look at, I mean, back in the glory days of CART, you had a new car every year from each manufacturer, and you had like four chassis manufacturers and four different engine manufacturers as well, and two tyre manufacturers to choose from. So it was this technical arms race as well, and you sort of don't have that now, apart from the dampers, which are the only part of the car you're allowed to modify, and the engines, whether you have a Chevy or a Honda, but they're so identical nowadays that it's really much of a muchness. So I think 2026, there's talk of there being an entirely new engine formula coming in for IndyCar, and perhaps that's when they get a new chassis as well to go with the new engine, but we'll have to wait and see on that.
Is it also a case of if it ain't broke, don't fix it? Like, the racing is so good. You see Formula One trying to work their way back through new regulations to try and bring the category closer together. Because we see such close racing in IndyCar most of the time, is it somewhat of a case of, as I mentioned, that if it ain't broke, don't fix it?
I think partially yes, but also they do need to change. Like, it's been the same formula for, what, I think 13, or going on 13 years now. Like, it's more than a decade. Like, you look at supercars, right? And each sort of iteration of supercar, that's only been going for about 10 years until it changes. So I do get the sort of the racing's fantastic and it doesn't need to change, but everyone's so familiar with the car now. They've got it all figured out. And the race at St. Petersburg over the weekend, it wasn't particularly a classic IndyCar race. Joseph Newgarden absolutely dominated for Team Penske, but there was some good action through the field. Scotty McLaughlin had a few dive bombs and ended up on the podium. But there seems to be just a little bit of uneasiness going around the IndyCar paddock at the moment, despite the fact that it still probably is, pound for pound, the best open wheel racing category in the world by some margin.
Yeah, and I mean, it's funny you said that, Anthony, because I was literally saying the same thing. And I know it's quite easy to get caught in nostalgia sometimes, like, because I recall bits and pieces of the... I mean, it wasn't on TV here in Australia, of course, growing up, but I am well aware of the story of the split between the open wheel categories in America, because I remember at one stage, kart almost was as big, if not bigger in some stages, just because of the marketing in terms of dollar for dollar value, as Formula One at one stage. You had Formula One world champions jumping back and forth between kart and Formula One. But how close was the racing? I mean, I can't remember watching too many, and you've got a lot of variables, such as, you know, four manufacturers, four engines, two tire compounds. Like, I remember supercars, when they were first supercars, back when they had multiple compounds as well, and, you know, HRT with Bridgestone, they had that relationship and they dominated for years. So I mean, it's kind of that balance, right, between a technically close category like what supercars are trying to become, and IndyCar, and I guess innovation too, because I mean, a category does kind of need to evolve or they risk becoming irrelevant.
Well, I mean, you look at Formula One and that's a technical arms race, and the field is probably the closest it's ever been. It's just, unfortunately, the fight's for second because Max Verstappen's so far ahead of the rest of the field. So, I mean, you say that we look back at these kinds of things with rose-tinted glasses, and kart on Champ Car wasn't the closest competition, but, like, when it was on, it's still genuinely some of the most brilliant motorsport viewing you can find online. I think back to the finish of the 2000 Michigan 500. It was Michael Andretti and Juan Pablo Montoya bashing wheels at 200 plus mile an hour photo finish at the finish line, ranging up on a lapped car in front, and Montoya used the draft from that lapped car to poke ahead and win the race, and he nearly ran over the back of him across the finish line. Like, kart genuinely, and it still probably is, the one category that I wish I got to see as a younger person who wasn't around during its heyday. But like, I mean, if I was...
And don't forget Sylvester Stallone.
Well, that's part of the reason it died. I don't want to watch that movie ever.
For those who don't know, that's the movie Driven.
Do not watch it, please. Just don't. But
you'll never want to watch another motorsport race in your life.
No, you won't. But yeah, no, like, I mean, if I was in charge of IndyCar, that's the regulation I'd use. 2.65 litre turbocharged V8s that rev to about 17,000 RPM and can go 250 mile an hour top speed on an oval. Anthony, you have your hand up.
Sorry, I forgot I had my hand up on my thing. Jeez, I'm no good at this Teams thing, am I? At least I wasn't on mute this time. Well, as we mentioned, obviously all this NASCAR stuff, this is all happening off track, but on track, Kiwi and Aussie expat Scott McLaughlin has had another great race, another great start to the championship, and finished third over the weekend.
Yeah, and Zach, you had pinned him for you reckon he's going to win the championship? I mean, I'm hopeful he wins the championship. Those model cars have got to go up in value somehow, and I think winning an IndyCar championship is going to help my collection cause.
Look, he is still my pick for the championship, but one thing I didn't count on was a rejuvenated Joseph Newgarden, who has gone on a social media blackout across the off-season. He's now not following anyone on social media, I think it is, or it might be the other way around, where he's blocked everyone who follows him, perhaps. No, I think it's the first one. He's incredibly focused now. Bus Bros is unfortunately no more. I know, very sad. But yeah, Joseph Newgarden looks like he's rejuvenated, and he says that he's found his love for motor racing again, which spells danger for the entire IndyCar field, because when Joseph Newgarden's on, he is genuinely one of the most talented racing drivers in the world, and I do think we could potentially be looking at maybe not even a two-way Penske fight for the title, but maybe even a three-way Penske fight for the title, because it was a Penske 1-3-4. Will Power finished fourth. They're only broken up by Pato O'Ward and the Arrow McLaren in second. So, ominous signs. Ganassi weren't quite there all weekend, which was a little bit bizarre, but you'd expect them to figure in the fight somewhere, especially with Alex Palou and Scott Dixon as their two drivers, or their two star drivers, I should say. Not a classic to open the IndyCar season. I think the star of the weekend was Felix Rosenquist at Meyer Shank Racing, the Andretti Global partner team, who was rapid all weekend and broke the track record in qualifying, but missed pole because he decided to do it in qualifying too. Couldn't quite replicate it, and he missed out on pole by, I think it was 36 ten-thousandths of a second or something incredibly tight. I'm pretty sure it's the closest front row in IndyCar history. So the competition's still there, but man, I tell you what, I think Penske are on it. And on the topic of Team Penske, this is an absolutely outrageous stat. They compete in four top-level series across the world, right? NASCAR, IndyCar, World Endurance Championship, and IMSA. They are currently leading all four major championships they are in. I mean, what else can you say about Team Penske? They are the best racing team on the planet, and they have been for a long time, and they will be for a long time.
Have they won the opening race of every category this year they've been in as well?
I'm trying to think of who won the Daytona 500. I don't think they won Daytona.
It wasn't Blaney, was it?
No, I don't think it was Blaney. Blaney won the championship last year, but
William Byron.
Yes, that's right. They've come close too, and Ryan Blaney is leading the NASCAR Cup Series point standings as it stands, I guess. We've seen it. Like Matt Campbell's been on fire for Porsche Penske Motorsport this year in both WEC and IMSA. Their IndyCar squad's always been firing. Even if they have a bad season, they're top five in the championship at a minimum. What else can you say about Team Penske? Like, they're truly a juggernaut, a force of motorsport nature.
Well, to counter your stat, Anthony, that where we're just discovering whether they won every race, the first race of all the seasons, the top Penske Ford in the Daytona 500 was Austin Cindric, who finished in 22nd.
Well, to be fair, I think the entire field got wiped out with about 9 laps to go, so...
Yeah, and I recall Logano being in that.
Yeah, Logano was in it, I think.
I think Cindric was in it too.
Yeah, Cindric was probably in it. Blaney, I think Blaney was probably in it too. Like it was literally everyone bar the first three cars all got wiped out in that wreck. So, yeah.
Yeah, the top Ford was Noah Gregson in ninth.
Well, there you go. Can you tell I don't pay too much attention to NASCAR Cup racing then?
Oh, well, it was a while ago, so...
Well, that's all going to change with Lee Diffie on lead commentary now, won't it?
Of course, because it'll be on Fox and I'll want to listen to it.
let's move across to, instead of talking about Cup and American stuff, let's head back over to Europe, which took a trip to the Middle East. And Anthony, you might know a little bit more about what went on in Saudi Arabia in Formula One. All right. Formula One time, Saudi Arabia Grand Prix. It was okay. It helped having a certain smooth operator not having a... Well, he had a smooth operation, which caused him to not compete in the Saudi Arabian Grand Prix.
Oh, wow. I didn't think that was where that was going. Oh, that is you've earned your point back after your Lindsay Lohan mishap before. You've earned that one back. Well done.
Well, to be fair, Carlos Sainz has officially won Formula One social media this year. Have you seen the post that he's put up on his social media of him recovering in his bed with Carlos Sainz Sr., his father, sitting next to him?
Yep, and it's appendicitis 2, Carlos Sainz 0.
Yes, because Carlos Jr. was replicating a photo Carlos Sr. had taken when he had his appendix taken out many moons ago. It is absolutely outstanding viewing. If you haven't seen it, please do check it out. But
we might have to share it on our story at the Pitlane _ punters.
Oh, gee, it's almost like we have social media that we should use, isn't it? but yeah, no, unfortunately, Carlos ruled out. He tried to soldier on through Friday or Thursday practice, it was, of course, with it being in the Middle East during Ramadan. He got through practice one and two, but then unfortunately he had to have his appendix out. He was at the track on Saturday night, though, where he watched 18-year-old Ferrari protege Oliver Bearman put in an absolutely outstanding debut, only having free practice three in the car to get used to it. And by the way, Oliver had taken pole in Formula 2 the day before on Thursday, and he had to withdraw from Formula 2. So now he's last in the Formula 2 standings, but by the same token, he's also 10th in the Formula 1 standings. So I think he'd take that.
Yeah, and I guess I've been listening and watching a few people's thoughts on Ollie Bearman, and I think his performance at Saudi Arabia and being able to hold off a fast-charging Norris and Hamilton at the end of the Grand Prix as well, which was probably where he got a lot of credit for, as well as matching his teammates' pace by the end of the race. His seventh place at the Grand Prix in Formula 1 is probably better. He's probably in a better position, has more stock, I would say, or his stocks are higher than what he would have been if he won the Formula 2 World Championship.
Yeah, no, I'd agree with that. And let's not forget, after only spending an hour in the car, he came within a whisker of putting the thing into Q3. It only took a lap from Sir Lewis Hamilton to knock him out of qualifying three.
And he was held up, wasn't he?
He had two laps. He made a mistake on his first lap, which sort of used up the best of the tyre. But then again, he nearly put it into Q3, having used the best of the tyre. The kid's got so much raw talent and pace to burn. He was arguably the rookie of the season in Formula 2 last year, or maybe he was officially. And to come back, and he drove a faultless race on Saturday night, Saudi Arabian time. He did not put a foot wrong. Finished P7 and at P10 in the standings. And let's just list off all the drivers he's ahead of in the Formula 1 World Championship point standings at the moment, because it's absolutely fantastic. So Bearman is ahead of Nico Hülkenberg, Lance Stroll, Alex Albon, Guan Yu Zhou, Kevin Magnussen, Daniel Ricciardo, Esteban Ocon, Yuki Tsunoda, Logan Sargeant, Valtteri Bottas, and Pierre Gasly. It's not exactly like he's ahead of the rear gun tail end Charlies. He is ahead of some properly established Grand Prix superstars. I mean, I always thought that he was going to get a seat next year. I think one of the Haas seats was always going to be Oliver Bearman's next season. But if that hasn't confirmed it, I don't know what will. Maybe we get a repeat performance in Australia if Carlos doesn't recover. I don't know.
Here's a question for you. If this happened, a month or two ago? Well, whenever Ferrari signed Hamilton. Do you think they signed Hamilton?
Yep.
You think they still sign Hamilton?
Yep.
He's Lewis Hamilton. He's the statistical greatest of all time. You're not exactly going to pass that up to take a punt on an 18-year-old kid. As much as Bearman might have more upside, but he's only 18. He can just slot straight into Hamilton's seat once he retires, because Lewis isn't getting any younger. So,
do you reckon that's the plan? Get him into a Haas seat as soon as possible, and then when Hamilton leaves, Bearman to Ferrari?
I definitely believe so.
Seems like a logical step.
Well, seat time, isn't it? We see that. I mean, we see that even in Australia, supercars guys going out and jumping into GT cars and the Trans Am cars just to keep match fit. I mean, hell, they even jump in production cars at about the 6 hour if they really want to. So, yeah, seat time, especially in a Formula One car. It doesn't matter if you're at the back end of the field. Case in point, George Russell at Williams, right? I mean, how long was he at Williams for? Started off there in 2019 and by 2022, he was a full-blown factory Mercedes driver, having stood in for Lewis Hamilton at the 2020 yes, 2020 Sakhir Grand Prix, I think it was, the second Bahrain race during COVID. And, I mean, he...
That he very nearly won.
Yeah, that he very nearly won, absolutely destroyed Valtteri Bottas, who everyone expected to win the race.
But then he borrowed Bottas's pit crew.
Well, yes, but, I mean, yeah.
Bottas's Monaco pit crew.
I'm still fuming that George didn't win that race, to be perfectly honest. But, yeah, Oliver Bearman, we're going to hear that name a lot more. And to be honest, if Oliver Bearman hadn't put that performance in, how much more would we be talking about Oscar Piastri finishing fourth? And currently being fifth in the points standings.
Two young, great, up-and-coming race car drivers that I think we'll be hearing their names for a long time to come. Awesome race car drivers. Don't know how much longer we'll be hearing about him for. Daniel Ricciardo having another tough run at the Saudi Arabia Grand Prix. An awkward spin towards the end of... Was it towards the end of the Grand Prix or qualifying? I can't quite remember. In front of the guy whose seat he's gunning for, Sergio Perez.
Yeah, it was a bit of an unfortunate situation for Daniel Ricciardo towards the end of the race, but he's also not in the greatest machinery. So was it driver error or was it a bit of car fault? I didn't see it happen towards the end of the race, so I'm not quite sure. But yeah, not the greatest thing for Daniel Ricciardo, but he's a lovable character. I'm sure we'll see him bounce back come the Australian Grand Prix next weekend, where there will be two Aussies on the grid for the first time since 2013.
What? No, I thought it was for the first time ever. But we'll touch on that later. But going back to what you were saying about Daniel being in a bad car, what on earth's happened to Visa, Cashapp, Minardi, Toro Rosso, AlphaTauri, RB? I mean, what's happened to them? They were...
Put that on a t-shirt.
They were... Pit Lane Punters merch. Maybe. I mean, what's happened to them? They were on the pace in testing and everyone was talking about how they were going to have a great season. And now they're nil pois from the first two races. Yuki Tsunoda just about started a civil war within the team in Bahrain. Maybe they were selling us some lies. Maybe they'd taken out some sandbags when everyone else had left some in.
Who knows? But another fun fact on... the second Red Bull team, that's how I'm going to reference it because there's too many names that it's been through, but Daniel Ricciardo has now raced under all four of those names for the second Red Bull team. He raced at Toro Rosso. He raced at AlphaTauri. He's, of course, raced for Red Bull Racing in the top flight, and he's now at Visa Cash App Red Bull Racing Bulls. So he's raced for the four different iterations of the Red Bull family. Only driver to do so.
I thought you were trying to tell me you raced for Minardi, and I was about to say it would have been a young Minardi driver.
No.
I guess in terms of Red Bull news, there's a lot of things swirling around about the mass exit. It's, well, Red Bull doing an Erebus, essentially, and having a mass exodus. And it's looking like potentially the godfather of ground effects and Formula One cars, Adrian Newey, is potentially on the way out.
Oh, I still don't think much change is going to happen at Red Bull. I just don't know why Ferrari would be such a tantalising prospect with, don't get me wrong, Charles Leclerc's a great driver, but boy, he's error prone, isn't he? Like, he can overdrive a car if it's not to his liking or to the performance standards he wants. And I hate to say it, but Lewis Hamilton isn't the Lewis Hamilton who won 7 drivers' championships. I really don't think Lewis Hamilton's the driver he once was. Don't get me wrong, he's still a phenomenal racing driver and still better than a lot of the Formula One grid, but yeah, I still don't think he's the guy who went on an absolute rampage in the mid to late 2010s.
But Adrian Newey has been on the record to say that, A, he has wanted to work for Ferrari and that he has wanted to work with Lewis Hamilton. So, of course, Ferrari are going to try and throw the book at him to try and get him to come across. And with Red Bull the way they are at the moment, with all the different situations happening surrounding Christian Horner and Helmut Marko, and will or will they not be sacked or stood down in upcoming events? You'd want to try and get away from the potential sinking ship if you could, wouldn't you?
Oh, but the one thing Red Bull are that Ferrari aren't, Red Bull are successful. And Red Bull are frighteningly successful. Like, why would you stop making cars that are designed to drive, that are designed to fit the driving style of the guy who is the dominant force in Formula One at the moment? And the thing is, Ferrari can build the best car in the world all they want, but what's the point if their strategists haven't passed year 10 math? Like, really? You can build an absolute rocket ship, and you can still throw it all the way in the pits. So I just struggle to see where the upside is for Adrian Newey and a lot of the Red Bull staff to go to Ferrari when they've already got something that's so successful. And let's be properly blunt about it, it doesn't look like it's going to be stopped anytime soon, at least from one side of the garage.
Well, maybe they've all watched The Last Dance on Netflix and thought back to the Ferrari heydays of the Michael Schumacher, and they all want to go back for one last dance, want to be a part of it. It's not the same people, but same concept.
Well, I mean, maybe. I don't know. We're obviously not privy to these private conversations, but...
We're not punters in that pit lane.
No, we're very much not. But, I mean, yeah, if it does happen, kudos to Ferrari. If it doesn't happen, I also won't be surprised.
If it happens, bellissimo.
If it happens, Charles Leclerc's going to find a way to choke a championship, and Max Verstappen will still be world champion.
Here comes Lewis Hamilton! On the note of Ferrari, though, it is probably worth mentioning some of the biggest news that's kind of affecting them. It's not affecting them on the track, more off the track. The Felipe Massa lawsuit has got legs, and he's not so much suing Ferrari, but suing the FIA.
Well, interesting. Suing them for lost bonuses and contract or pay increases that he would have received had he won the 2008 World Championship. Now, of course, he lost it fair and square in Brazil, right? You know, is that Glock? Yada, yada, yada. Hamilton goes through. Ferrari mechanic headbutts the wall and smashes the Ferrari sign. We all know that, right? But, I mean, the contention's all around Singapore. Crashgate. Nelson Piquet being told to crash by Renault management so Fernando Alonso could win the race. Hamilton finished third in that race. Massa didn't score any points. Now, granted, it was a Ferrari pit stop nightmare, which... before it was cool, but I mean, I don't know. Felipe was forced onto a different strategy because of it. There's been a lot of chat about whether the results should be voided because the FIA had prior knowledge of the incident before they investigated it in 2009, and before Nelson Piquet came out and publicly said what had happened in 2009, which was after he got sacked from Renault. But I don't know if this has got legs. He's tried to get Singapore annulled. They said no, the result stands. So now he's suing them for, I think it's $125 million.
Yeah, the reports I've got in front of me are between a minimum of $124 million and $290 million. So there's a lot of money involved, and the matter is now going to be heard by the London High Court, where Massa is going to be represented by King's Counsel Nick DiMarco and Barrister Kendra Potts. Not that those names mean anything, but the fact that it's going all the way to the High Court in London.
Yeah, but let's be real about this. That losing the 2008 World Championship is not the reason that Felipe Massa's career went in a downward spiral. Like, the accident at Hungary where the spring from Rubens Barrichello's brawn hit him on the head, he was never the same driver since then. It wasn't helped by the fact Ferrari built an absolutely rubbish car for 2009 anyway, but he hasn't been the same driver since then. And I mean, yeah, I don't know if this will get up. If it does, then, I mean, what kind of a can of worms has that opened for other drivers to take legal action? Like, does Alain Prost decide to take legal action because Senna didn't get a points penalty for taking him out in Suzuka in 1990? I don't know. Like, I just worry that if it does get up, this could set a very dangerous precedent for championships to be won in the courtrooms and not out on track where they should be.
Well, would this then open the door for Lewis Hamilton to then sue the FIA for 2021?
Well, exactly right. Hopefully... common sense prevails, but yeah, we'll wait and see.
Well, guys, we've just about run out of time, but there was one more thing quickly on my list. It's not Formula One related. It is world news related. It looks like Cadillac and Ganassi are set to split after this year's WEC. It thought it was big enough news to tap onto the back. We won't be diving too much into WEC, but I guess 30-second thoughts on that one, Zach?
Surprising, yet not surprising at the same time. Hasn't been the most successful of marriages, particularly on the World Endurance Championship scene. They've been reasonably successful in IMSA competition, but yeah, interesting. They've had a long running relationship with Ford, having run the Ford GT GTE program in WEC and in IMSA back in the late 2010s, and there's been a lot of chat about Ford potentially wanting to run a hypercar program, so join two and two, maybe. I don't know, we'll see.
Forget girl maths, it's all about race car motorsport maths. On that note, guys, thank you so much for your time this evening. And of course, if you've enjoyed the podcast, make sure you follow and subscribe it. And of course, we have social media too, at @pitlane_punters. We've been trying to do a little bit better, share as much news as we can as it comes across our screens on our stories and whatnot, but we'd really appreciate a follow. But yeah, boys, thank you so much for your time. And it's been another exciting week of motorsport news, hasn't it?
It definitely has. And next week, the Formula One circus rolls into Melbourne, and we'll be having a podcast go up on Friday morning of the event. So looking forward to getting all our pre-F1 event chats. Plus, we'll also have our normal supercars predictions to do for the weekend as well.
Well, we could even do a review of Supercars Race 1, because I believe that will be on Thursday, will it not?
Oh, potentially. I can't remember. I haven't looked at the schedule yet, but we'll work that out and go from there.
But, of course, before we get to next weekend at the Australian Grand Prix, a very quick wrap of what's going on in the world of motorsport this weekend. Speed Series is back on. Race Tasmania at Simmons Plains, highlighted by TCR Australia and Trans Am. TCR Australia, a thin field of 13 cars, but it's a very competitive field. Trans Am, a great 20-car field, absolutely jam-packed with talent and headlined by the return of Nathan Hearn from the US of A. Speaking of the US of A, the Sebring 12-hour is on, the second round of the IMSA Sports Car Championship, where Matt Campbell will look to continue his frankly ridiculous start to the 2024 season for Porsche Penske Motorsport. Formula E is back on this weekend with the Sao Paulo E-Prix, and NASCAR Cup Series is at Bristol on the high banks at the Bullring.
Awesome stuff, Zach. Awesome stuff, Anthony. Thank you so much for your time, boys, and we'll see you next week on the Pit Lane Punters podcast. You've been listening to the Pit Lane Punters podcast. Make sure you like, subscribe, follow, and ring the notification bell wherever you get your podcasts. And if you get a spare chance, leave us a 5-star review. It really helps us in the algorithm. And now, exclusive to Spotify listeners, we've unlocked the Q&A function. So if you have a question about the podcast, how we make it, or just have any motorsport questions in general, we'd love to hear from you, we'd love to answer them, and we'd love to engage with you. That's it from us. See you next time on the Pit Lane Punters podcast.